Hello, Voices of Wrestling listener. Dave Ryan here. Have you ever wondered to yourself how many hidden gems are hidden away inside the last years of World Championship Wrestling? Have you ever asked yourself how many tenuous gags can be made about the name Mike Enos? And have you ever thought about what it sounds like for two Irishmen to interpret a very chaotic company through its B-show? The answers to all this and more are just a click away. Check out Days of Thunder every second Thursday on the Voices of Wrestling podcast network.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling podcasting network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Competition's starting to get thick. It's the click, so I hope you brought your A game. A made no rains on the track when we unite and spit. This isn't A game. Better bring your A game. Competition's starting to get thick. It's the click, so I hope you brought your A game. A made no rains on the track.
Hey now, it's the Mike and JD Show, and I'm your host, Mike Gilbert, and I'm typically joined by JD, by God Oliva, and you will hear his voice on this episode. However, we are doing a very special episode because JD and myself, we are just swamped and overbooked for the holidays with work and travel and school and everything that we got going on, and I actually am going to be, hopefully here in the next couple of hours, I will be flying out to California, God willing, if our plane takes off. We've had some issues with that. But hopefully it takes off, and I will be in California. And I have family just all over that area. And it's the worst thing ever. And I love family. But, you know, when you fly across an ocean to go see everybody, they still want you to come to all their individual houses. And so that's what I'm going to be up to. So I don't know when I would be getting away. And I also am not going to be bringing my computer and my microphone and my whole setup because of the instability that we're going to have when we're out there, because we're going to be in so many different places. So I'm just recording this right now, and what we're going to do is I am going to drop a double shot of our Patreon right here on the Voices of Wrestling Radio Network for free. JD and I, when we started the Mike and JD Show back in April, we started a new podcast for the old Fight Game Media Patreon called Mike and JD Show Extra. And what we would do is we would just do like historical deep dives. We would take specific events, storylines, angles, events, whatever. And we would just go kind of down a rabbit hole for about 45 minutes to an hour. And a lot of it was just based off of the articles that JD was writing, because where JD really is at his best is as a writer, and he is a tremendous writer of history. He loves writing about history pieces about pro wrestling. So the first one we did was called The Mystery of the Black Scorpion, based off of an article that JD had written. And so you're going to get a chance to listen to that. I think it's really relevant right now because the top storyline in AEW is the Devil storyline, and there are a lot of parallels between the Black Scorpion and the Devil storyline, just as there's a lot of parallels between the Devil and Aces and Eights from TNA, which we dropped a couple weeks ago. I did an Aces and Eights retrospective, and if you take a look at that storyline, there's a lot of similarities there. So if Aces and Eights and the Black Scorpion had a baby, that would be the Devil storyline. I just hope that the Devil plays a lot better on television, or the payoff is a lot better than what we got with Aces and Eights and the Black Scorpion. But so yeah, that's going to be the first one. And then the second one was we recorded over the summer when we had transitioned over to our own podcasting network. When we started the Mike and JD Show Patreon, we dropped this one. Now, both episodes have already been on the Patreon since for months and months and months. I think the second one we did over the summer, it was about Bill Watts taking over WCW in 1992. And this is when we transitioned to our overtime series. So, on the Bill Watts 1992, that was in response to somebody's terrible article where they had stated that AEW should go back in time and hire guys from 30 years ago to book their television show. And they had name dropped guys like Dutch Mantel and Jim Cornette and all these other people. I think Eric Bischoff was the name. And JD did an article about the time that WCW got desperate and decided to go back in time and hire an old booker from a wrestling territory named Bill Watts, who was a big time booker in the South. And it was very successful in his territory. And then, of course, that territory went out of business. So, and then he sold to Crockett, and naturally WCW decided to hire him 5 years after he'd been out of wrestling. So we talk about the disaster that was Bill Watts in 1992. In WCW. So take a listen. And if you like this content, there's tons more over on our Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/TheMikeAndJDShow. And thank you for listening to the show this week. And JD and I will be back most likely in the new year with some fresh new content. It depends on my travel schedule, but I don't think that we're going to be taking too much time away. We really are committed to this network and committed to the podcast. I will be dropping some brief audio here and there on the Patreon, just using my cell phone, not really podcast material, but you know, as news breaks, I like to just pull out my phone and do a voice memo, record directly to my phone, and upload it right to Patreon. So if you guys are interested in that, just be on the lookout for that. We're still going to be updating the YouTube for a while, but this week we are just going to give you guys some pretty cool classic content right here on the Voices of Wrestling Radio Network. And until next time, mahalo. Hey now, it's the Mike and JD Show, and I'm your host, Mike Gilbert, and I'm joined as always by JD by Gottlieb. How you doing, JD?
Episode 2.
Episode 2 of our Patreon deep dives that we're doing, doing a lot of historical stuff, man. Our last one was a ton of fun. We looked at the history between Kenny Omega and Don Callis using one of JD's old school articles as a source material. We got a lot of good feedback on it, and we've been excited to do this one for a while, man. Black Scorpion.
This was the one we wanted to start with, and then we decided to change course because of the Don Callis heel turn, right? Yeah. Just kind of he made that viable again, and we're like, oh, we'll just talk about this, and we'll kick the Scorpion to the curb for a little bit, because the Black Scorpion, God, it's a 33-year-old storyline, mm-hmm. but I think it's like the ultimate of what could have been in WCW. And there's a reason I like talking about the Scorpion, because like if you follow WWE right now, the big controversy from the summer, or from the spring, I should say, was Cody Rhodes should have been the champion by now, right? He should have beaten Roman Reigns. It was set up for that. And then Paul Heyman, of all people, came out and said, if Cody wins, the story is over. And a lot of people push back against that narrative. And to them, I say, when you have a hero, right? The hero journey is like the template of most modern Western storytelling. The hero has a goal, something stands in front of him. He has to overcome that, whatever thing could be. It could be force of nature, it could be a villain, it could be himself, it could be anything. Something is staying in front of the hero, and the hero has to conquer this mountain. And when the hero conquers the mountain, that is typically the end of a story, right? So oftentimes in pro wrestling, the story of the good guy is trying to get to the moment, right? And then oftentimes in wrestling history, when the hero gets there, what happens then? Mm-hmm. Right? Because like when you think about it, what was the grand story of Hulk Hogan winning the WWF World Championship the first time?
That was a little bit of a different thing, because he had just gotten there and Iron Sheik had just won the title, but it was like defeating the Iranian villain.
But right. Was it built up? No, it was Hulk Hogan. It was literally the week before Hulk Hogan is going to take Bob Backlund's place.
Yeah.
It was not about the journey.
Mm-hmm.
The story started when Hogan won the title, right? Bret Hart does not have, like, you can look at it as a career retrospective to get to that moment. Like, you can look at it from the 10 years it took. But in reality, in the story, he just beat Ric Flair.
Yeah,
and then randomly. The story started super randomly.
Yeah,
player was hurt.
What was it? Saskatoon in like 1992.
Saskatoon, '92.
Weird. Yeah. God, man, I can't remember stuff from yesterday, but I can remember Saskatoon.
Saskatoon. Yes, I will. I don't know where Saskatoon is. I'm sure like Paul or some or Preet could point it out on a map. I couldn't tell you where Saskatoon is. I'm from America, but I mean, like, I will always know of Saskatoon because that's where Bret Hart won the title. Right? I mean, like, very rarely does, in wrestling specifically, does the hero story finish, like, continue, like, right? Because that's a different story, right? The holding of the title. And this is, like, especially in WCW, which was a heel-based territory, right? The heel was the champion. Flair had always been the champ, and they wanted to put the belt on Sting. If you don't know the story, Flair and Sting are, have our teammates, right, in 89. And then throughout the end of the year. And then the end of the year, Sting joins the Horsemen. Flair's babyface at this time. And then they tell Sting, who had won the Future Shock Starrcade 89 tournament to determine the number one contender. And Ole Anderson, who's also now the booker at this time, tells Sting he has to give it up. Sting says, no, I want a shot at Flair. I want to try to wrestle Flair for the belt. And they turn on Sting, and the Horsemen attack Sting. At the end of the show, they have the Thunder cage set up. Sting jumps up to climb up the cage, and he blows his patella tendon. Mm-hmm. So yeah. What was meant to be quick, because he was supposed to beat Flair at the next show, right? Which I think was Wrestle War 90, I think. I forget.
Yeah, did he blow his knee at Super Brawl or was
he blew it on Clash? He blew it on the Clash
of the Champions. So yeah. was it Super Brawl that he was going to win the title at?
I remember the next time. He went from being a random mid carder to a guy, but I mean, it's not like they rocket strapped him. It takes 2 full years for Sting to be the guy, right? Hulk Hogan comes back. He has the world title in less than a month. Sting, when they decide to make him, is 2 years. Now, again, a lot of that, too, is because of the injury. But, like, Flair was a man of his word. He put Sting over. The problem with all this is when Sting wins the title, the worst thing to do is, like, to keep the feud with Flair going. Because Flair, even though he's a heel in WCW, like, nobody booed him ever. Nobody booed Flair. And it was hard. So they didn't really want to put Flair back in it. At this point, like, the Horsemen feud with Doom. Do you remember the Horsemen Doom feud in the fall of 1990? Yes. Like, it's like super racially tinged. Like, there's some there's some interviews.
Well, I mean, that's Ole Anderson, right?
There you go.
The old Georgia territory. Like, they literally hired a literal racist to run the company. And next thing you know, you got racism angles on your TV. That's right. What you get with Ole Anderson. But yeah, no, you're absolutely right. They didn't really have anything for Sting to do after he won the title. I want to get into your Russell Joy article real quick. And I want to read some of this verbatim. Yeah, so I'll set the table. So Anderson comes in to take over. Everybody's kind of puzzled with this. And so JD states, while Anderson was a hugely successful booker in the old Georgia territory, and we're talking about a decade prior to this, right? Yes. Georgia was on fire in like 1980, around that time frame.
81.
Yeah, it had been 6 years since he led a promotion. The angle that defined his tenure atop WCW was a follow-up to the two-year story that led to Sting finally dethroning Ric Flair for the NWA World Heavyweight title. It was supposed to be an intriguing mystery meant to help build the company's big babyface attraction. However, during the rise of Sting, a storyline in it said that itself was chock full of colossal mistakes. The company failed to build up the Stinger's first significant challenger. Instead, WCW struggled to figure out what to do with their top hero after dethroning Flair. It didn't help that the NWA-WCW audience wasn't ready to let go of Flair as their top guy. Instead of lining up a series of short-term dragons for Sting to slay while trying to build up a potent threat to challenge Sting for the title at, say, Starrcade, WCW went in a different direction. Under Anderson, they created the mysterious Black Scorpion.
Oh, I thought you were going to hit play on the promo.
I am hitting play on the promo. It's not playing.
From the mysterious Black Scorpion, the man that this man, the World Heavyweight Champion Sting, has signed to defend his championship against, live here on TBS on September 5th. Sting, do you know anything about this man? And if not, how are you preparing to wrestle him?
Well, I have no idea, Bob, who this guy is, the Black Scorpion.
Sting was
no
such
clue.
A bad promo back then.
No one's saying anything to me. I've seen this little bit right now.
I'll tell you, we can comment over this stuff.
You ever see when Sting tries to do the surfer accent? There's a time in 89 where they got Sting talking like Michelangelo.
He is an unknown. How do I prepare for something like that? Well, you just have to go for broke.
They never protected him.
Any of the stars in the NWA, at least I have an idea on how to prepare for something like that. But this guy here, Bob, the Black Scorpion, I have no idea who he is.
Yeah.
But I said on national
TV, the names he just listed off were now that I would like, against anybody I don't know, not worth it. Yeah.
The dudes were just there that day.
They would get an idea who he is, Sting. And to do that, fans, let's watch this.
Yeah, let's watch it.
Sting, are you listening? Of course you are. You're too much of a hero and a champion to refuse to hear this tape. Sting, I am going to destroy you. A long time has passed since you last saw me.
Listen.
Oh yes, you know me. Or at least you did.
Oh yes.
But don't try to track me down. It won't help. Even if you saw my face in light, you wouldn't recognize me. My face doesn't look the same. Curious. I imagine you are. Of course you are. I want you to be thinking, be concerned, maybe even a little scared.
I'm concerned.
Soon, I intend for you to be terrified.
There's nothing least scary than a guy telling you to be scared.
Yeah.
That would hate you enough.
The eerie music in the background.
Did
Jimmy Jacobs write this?
I'm convinced it's what Jimmy Jacobs was inspired by his entire career.
How about California?
Oh, how about California? California 86. Take note of that one. That's a clue.
I don't know why I am. Remember this. You have a chance to find out on September 5th at the Clash at Mountain Madness. I'll be there waiting.
Mountain Madness.
So that was the debut of the Black Clash. Scorpion.
Great Clash sub. I miss those Clashes with the subtitles. Like Chi-Town Rumble, like those were his great. Mountain Madness was probably my favorite. So, okay, this was Ole's great idea. Rather than use somebody, by the way, I did all that. I should just let you read my own words. I'm like, oh, I just said that. Wait, I summed that up much clearer back then. So I'm an
idiot. It's okay.
But anyways, so Ole's great idea was to create a new character rather than pushing somebody. So I want you to Ole gives hints. He goes, you know me. You know who I am. My face looks different. You wouldn't recognize me today. Do you remember California in 86? Okay, today I have to hear on every podcast, everybody says that pro wrestling is too inside, that the casual fan doesn't know what anyone is talking about. This is 33 fucking years ago, and he's and fucking Ole, by the way, that is Ole Anderson doing the voice.
Yes.
Fucking
yes.
Ole Anderson is talking about Power Team USA.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody watching WCW Saturday night in not nobody. 10 people who watched WCW Saturday night in 1990 knew what Power Team USA was. Let me refresh this. Red Bastien, Rick Bassman had this idea where he was going to find four. If one Hulk Hogan can work, four Hulk Hogans would be great. So he found four random ass bodybuilders, and we're going to turn them into professional wrestlers. I have this picture in the article of Bassman with four dudes. One of them is Sting. Two of them you don't know about because they didn't make it past that promo picture. And the other one is a very large man with a kind of a mullety brown hair, right? Those two, Sting and him, they go to Memphis, and I forget what they're known as in Memphis. I think it's just Power Team USA.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's still Power Team USA, right? And that dude is Jim Helwig, right? Mm-hmm. Steve Borden, Jim Helwig, that's the first team. They're in Memphis. They're baby faces. It is awful. I think I attached the video to the article. Terrible.
Yeah,
it's absolutely awful. You talk about Sting. This is Sting great at promos. You should see him in 1986, how bad Sting and Jim Helwig are at promos. So they leave. They turn heels because they didn't have his baby faces. They turn heels in Memphis. And then Lawler kind of they had that relationship with Mid-South UWF, right? With Watts. So when they're done in Memphis, they send them all down. And then Watts takes a look at these two roided up dudes, which let's be honest, that's what they were. They were two roided up dudes and said, hey, you know what the most successful duo of roided up dudes were? The Road Warriors. We'll make some knockoff Road Warriors and call them the Blade Runners.
Right. Flash the Blade. Rock. Blade Runner was a pretty big movie at the time, too.
So. It actually was not a pretty big movie.
It was not, really.
No, it was actually a big failure.
Okay. Maybe it's like a cult thing. Then.
Yeah, okay. It got big after. So Ridley Scott had a bunch of failure releases. But it's same as Road Warriors, took a title from an 80s movie that sounds really cool, The Road Warrior, Blade Runner, and then you have the Blade Runners, Sting and Rock. That's a heel tag team in the UWF. Rock leaves. Rock goes to World Class and rechristens himself the Dingo Warrior, who later, of course, would go to WWF as the Ultimate Warrior.
The Ultimate Warrior, yeah.
So again, most of your listeners probably know all that. So again, who the hell is he referencing, right? if you know this, if you are an insider fan, if you understand any of this, the only person that only Anderson could be talking about is the Ultimate Warrior.
Yeah, like, and this was in 1990 in the middle of the Ultimate Warrior's title run.
Correct. This is this is July or September of 1990. About 4 months after he's defeated Hulk Hogan at WrestleMania 4. This is what's madness about all this. It's because, and there's people, there's WCW fans that who knew, who thought, hey man, Warrior might leave and go to WCW, or maybe we'll get a champion versus champion match. Not anybody with the right mind, but I mean, like, because you could easily have done this angle and just be like, I'm someone from your past, you won't remember me, da 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 da, and it would have been whatever. But the fact that he clearly steers into Sting's real history is setting up is clearly just working the sheet readers. Like, there's nothing else that it could have been, right?
Yeah, because nobody would have known about Power Team USA. Nobody knew that he was tag team partners with Jim Hellwig and all that stuff, and that he'd started with him. So yeah, he was definitely leaning in, hoping that Dave would cover it.
100%. Yeah. And hoping Dave would talk about it. Of course, Dave, I have not read any of Dave's coverage of this, because I don't have to read Dave's coverage to tell you that he would have said the Ultimate Warrior is not coming to WCW. The World Wrestling Federation champion is not coming to WCW to do a babyface versus babyface match.
Yeah, and if I were able to talk to Ole, I would say, Ole, you know, maybe don't tease something you know you can't deliver on.
Isn't that like rule 101 for promotion?
Yeah, it's just bad form. I know he's just trying to get people talking, you know, and get people interested in the product. But what you don't do is tease something that you know you have no chance of delivering on.
Right.
And there was no chance of delivering on it. Okay, a year later, there was a chance, right?
Because he lost
the title in 91, and then he got fired, right? So
did Ole Anderson, coincidentally.
That's true, yeah.
So, you know, a little prophetic on both sides there. But that's what's crazy about this whole story. And then when the Scorpion does show up in Mountain Madness, he's a dude in a mask doing magic tricks. And when I say magic tricks, I mean like lame-ass shit that you would see from a kid's like party magician, right? Like,
yeah. Yeah, it's goofy shit. So the Black Scorpion was an unknown mystic who showed up in the promotion, and he immediately challenged Sting, as we just heard. Mm-hmm. The mystery of the Scorpion revolved around his identity. Unlike most masked man gimmicks, the Scorpion is only in the shadows, taunting the champ with clues and riddles to his identity. The challenge was made for the September 1990 Clash of Champions. Here, the Scorpion is just another masked man, and when Sting unmasks him mid-match, the champ is shocked to see the assailant wearing another mask. What the hell is this shit? And then rather than removing the next mask, Sting, who is always a stupid babyface, stands in awe as the second Scorpion shows up on the rampway. And rather than removing the next mask, for the next several months, Sting is tormented by the Scorpion, who performs rudimentary magic tricks while teasing Sting about the mystery of his identity. And eventually Sting and Scorpion face each other again in the main event of Starrcade 1990. So we'll stop there. But yeah, he's just doing magic tricks. And didn't he like... There was this one scene, because this lady just died recently. I can't think of her name. I should have actually looked it up. But there was a plant in the crowd who was a female wrestler who recently just died. I can't remember her name. And the Black Scorpion did like a mind control thing over her and had her attack Sting in one of the poor segments.
This is unbelievable. The crazy part is just like I mentioned, I kind of downplay this a little bit. Sting has the match with him at Starrcade. Starrcade is in December.
Yeah.
This is in September, right? And they had another pay-per-view before that. Yeah. That's what's nuts about this.
Yeah.
So like at Halloween Havoc. And you remember who Sting wrestles at Halloween Havoc 1990?
Oh, God. Wyndham?
No. Kind of.
It was because Wyndham came in Wyndham. As the fake Sting and mm-hmm. got pinned by Sid Vicious, right?
Sid Vicious.
Yes. I remember now.
Because Sid is in the Horseman at this point, which is actually a good move. Like bringing Sid... Yeah. Like, okay, I know we're a Wrestling Observer affiliated like kind of deal. The newsletter, I will go to my grave with this. The newsletter knock on Sid is wrong. Sid rules.
Yeah, it is.
Sid did in fact rule the world. He was awesome. There was so much charisma and athleticism dripping off that guy. Like, people are like, why do they push this guy? Because he's great. Yes, he's unreliable.
Awesome. Yeah.
Yes, he's unreliable. But yes, look at this man.
He loves softball. But I will say, yes, they were wrong about Sid. However, Dave Meltzer's nickname for him is Cycle Sid was pretty hilarious. Yeah.
It was 1990. And look at the man. Yeah. Just look at the man. So yeah, Sting and Sid have this match at 1990's Halloween Havoc. Great show, by the way. If anybody ever has a chance to go back and watch Halloween Havoc 90, in a year for WCW that is really kind of, it's a really good show. The Nasty Boys and the Steiners have this awesome match that's like kind of ahead of its time as far as just being like a wild, like hardcore style brawl. Like it's really good. Like it's
my favorite. It's my favorite Halloween Havoc, I think.
It's the best Halloween Havoc, quite frankly. Yeah. Like, it's really good shit. But so the end of that match is Barry Windham, who like has trademark long blonde hair, right? They have Barry Windham shave his head to look like Sting, to be a fake Sting, to take a dive so Sid can pin him. And even Jim Ross and Tony Schiavone are like, what the fuck is going on here? And then Sting comes out and pins, you know, Sid, and they're all like, and the whole crowd is like, what the fuck? I mean, we just told you it was a really good show. Take that dumb fuck finish out of it. Like, it's a good match.
It was a good match, and I get what they were trying to do. It was a wacky finish. I didn't really particularly care for the finish, but I still liked the whole show. No. Yeah. You got to remember that in 1990, I was 7. So stuff that you like when you're 7, you typically like when you're also 40.
I was 10, so I mean, like, I'm in the same boat as you. Like, so that's the finish of Halloween Havoc. Then they go into Starrcade. You get the big thing, Sting versus the Black Scorpion. They have the Black Scorpion. Of course, when you think of scorpions and magic, of course you would debut the Scorpion for his first match coming out of a spaceship.
Just classic stuff. Classic.
I mean,
stuff.
You can't make the ship. And then the Black Scorpion finally comes out. You take one look at the Black Scorpion and you go, oh, that's Ric Flair.
Like, yeah. Because he has the big nose. Come to the
nose.
Mask.
It's the nose. Yeah. Like, there's just, dude, you just know Ric Flair. And he's trying not to work like Ric Flair in the match, but it's clearly Ric Flair. And then Sting unmasks him, and that's Flair. And I think Barry Windham's another masked Sting in that one, too, or masked Scorpion in that one too. And so they finally end this thing. And Sting wins at Starrcade 90, and then Flair beats him a couple weeks later in a house show. And then they put an end to this thing. So like, people will talk about, oh man, Sting couldn't draw. Sting was terrible to draw as champion. You draw with that. Who the hell would draw with that if that's the creative you're given?
Right. They shit the bed, not Sting, because everything Sting did, like the matches were always really good, and he was always crazy over with the crowd.
Yeah.
They just couldn't line up the opponents that he needed to be able to draw.
Even when they tried, even when they like actually put real effort in, like Jake Roberts, like on paper, a Jake Roberts Sting feud should have been great. It started off really good, and then did not end well at all. Like, that's just the story. I mean, the only Sting doesn't have anyone to work with outside of Flair until Vader shows up, right?
And that's not until 92. And Cactus. He had some good stuff with Cactus.
He did have, it's true. He did have good, but Cactus wasn't supposed to be. Cactus was just supposed to be a monster for him to beat up. Like, the Cactus thing almost worked on accident because Mick Foley was just so damn good. Like, so again, like the whole part of my article, I wondered is, okay, we know that the Black Scorpion was a failure. We know they want, for some reason, they wanted to tease us that it was going to be the Ultimate Warrior, which clearly it wasn't. Who should have been the Black Scorpion? So that's kind of what I put three possible candidates in who I thought should be. So, I mean, like hearing about this whole thing, Mike, looking back on this, not taking my, you know, my article into consideration, who would you have booked as the Black Scorpion?
You know, the idea that I saw tossed around that I actually really liked, I don't know that it would have worked, but I would have liked to have seen them try it, would have been Eddie Gilbert.
That's the one I went with.
You know, because he was never really, like, he did do a little bit of drawing. He drew a little bit in Memphis. He was a really good worker. He was kind of seen as a geek in WCW, but I think at this point, he hadn't been around in a little bit, and he was friends with Sting. They had the UWF connection and all that stuff, and you could explain it away as him being from Sting's past. I think that I would have liked Eddie Gilbert. Would it have drawn? That I don't know, because it was Eddie Gilbert was never really seen as a top guy, but I think I still would have liked it.
So let's look at it this way. You got to take draw out of the equation because it didn't draw. Yeah. Right. The Black Scorpion, if you tell me the Black Scorpion angle was meant to draw, I'll call you a liar. And even Ole Anderson says the Scorpion angle was done for TV, right? To do something on TV. So, I mean, I put like, because it was played by Al Perez and the Angel of Death. The Angel of Death was a WCCW, world-class mid-card guy. Yeah, he looked kind of like Nikita Koloff. Wasn't great. So I pontificated him as one of them. I also said Luger. Luger could have been a Black Scorpion, because him and Sting always had that frenemy thing going, right? They were both best friend and hated enemy, which is what happens in 91. A year later, when Sting, Cactus comes in 91, and they're doing the famous Jim Cornette, come out of a box, you're over. That's what they were doing. Medusa was leading out these essentially giant refrigerator boxes, and it was Abdullah the Butcher and Cactus Jack coming out to beat up Sting, right? And that was Luger that was setting that up. Luger was the guy behind that, and they do the Luger heel turn. So if you'd have pushed something like that up a year, right? Because again, makes sense on paper. Luger is the guy that has been unable to beat Flair since 1988, right? Luger is the guy who has to hold the fort down while Sting is injured. Luger has been the U.S. champion basically since 1987 at this point, right? Luger holds that U.S. title for 3 years almost uninterrupted, right? But never gets that top belt. So on paper, it makes sense for your best friend to be super jealous of you, right? Because they won the Crockett Cup in 88. Together, like there's a relationship already. And again, they did it in 92. They basically did it again in 95 when Luger comes back. It would have worked if they'd have just pulled the trigger on it and made Luger. And it could have just written off as he was lying, right? Because he's Sting's best friend. So he knew enough about Sting to fuck with him, right? So Luger could have been the Black Scorpion. What do you think of that?
I think I like it. But Luger was such kind of like a clean cut suits and all this and that. I just don't know if that'd have been the right fit for him. Here's another thought. What about Dr. Death, Steve Williams? I know he was doing his Japan stuff at the time. Maybe he could have been done something like that. Maybe that would have been cool because they did try to get behind him a little bit when he first came over after UWF was purchased. What do you think about Dr. Death?
I never thought about Dr. Death because he's kind of in and out, and he's more concerned with All Japan in this era. But he does have a run with, like you said, like he's with the Varsity Club, right? Yeah. In 88, 89, and the original Tower of Doom, the original WCW Tower of Doom match. Ooh, that's bad. He's in that one. So, I mean, you could have done Steve Williams because he had been back and forth as babyface, and Steve Williams never really got a main event shot in the U.S. So that could have worked.
Yeah.
The problem is the angle. Like you said, Flair, Luger wouldn't have worked because he was a clean cut guy with all the suits. Yeah, so was Flair, and he was the Scorpion.
Right, and that wouldn't have worked. I just felt like you didn't, if you're going to turn Luger and push him against Sting, you wouldn't have needed to do the Black Scorpion thing. And of course, they shouldn't have done it with Flair. I think Eddie Gilbert would have been a good choice, but if they were trying to elevate somebody like an Eddie Gilbert, a guy who hasn't had a shot, that had been a little bit of a veteran, that had a history with Sting, you start looking at some of the guys from the UWF that happened to be either in the company or available at the time. Eddie Gilbert, obviously one of them. Dr. Death would have been another one. Rick Steiner was going to be my next guy. The problem with that is you break up probably the hottest tag team act that they had in the company.
In wrestling, basically.
Yeah.
Especially since the Road Warriors had left for WWF and the Steiners had really kind of taken their mantle as the tag team. Right, this because the Steiners, and if you haven't had a chance to see 1990, 1991 Steiner Brothers matches, they're awesome. Like,
my,
they're
my favorite tag team of all time.
Mine too.
Yeah.
Like, there's not even a close second. Like, they're doing stuff that's just off the charts. And in reality, they're just beating the ever-living shit out of people. But it looks really great on television. The only guy it could have been is Gilbert. And here's the thing. Eddie Gilbert was booking the UWF at the end of its existence, right? Eddie Gilbert is literally the final booker of the UWF. And even during the purchase, he's running the TV. Jim Crockett Productions really has no interest in having the UWF run as a second promotion. They just wanted the TV time slots. So almost immediately that thing gets shit on. And Eddie Gilbert really isn't happy with that. So he actually goes off after that and actually starts booking the old CWA or Continental Championship Wrestling territory, renames it the Continental Wrestling Federation. It kind of becomes like the toast indie of like the newsletter set for a long time. It never quite works out. And then he winds up back in WCW in 1989. And he was actually the point, like when Flair and Wyndham, he's feuding with Flair, right? In early 89, him and Wyndham, he is a mystery tag team, a partner for a match with Flair and Wyndham, and it's Steamboat. Like, he was actually the catalyst of Steamboat storyline, Steamboat's mm-hmm. return to WCW. And he's there, and there's a big heel turn planned for Eddie Gilbert, because he's a babyface. There's a big heel turn planned for Eddie Gilbert at Great American Bash 89, but Flair is the booker in 89, right? He's leading the committee. And Flair and Gilbert don't like each other. So Flair kind of like poo-poos it, and it never happens. So then Gilbert's gone from WCW kind of after that. And then he was not in the company in 1990. And this is why I'll argue it should have been Eddie Gilbert, because I believe he's back in Memphis at this time. If you can get Hot Stuff Eddie Gilbert back in, and if people can kind of swallow egos and realize what it is, the only person it could logically have been in storyline is Eddie Gilbert, because Eddie Gilbert is Sting's first manager. Sting and Ultimate Warrior at the time were part of Hot Stuff International. Eddie Gilbert mm-hmm. was their manager from the time they debut. Eddie Gilbert is the guy, right? And this is as a heel. They start as heels, then they turn babyface when the UWF buyout happens and they come into Crockett proper, right? And then Sting and Gilbert aren't really super aligned with each other anymore, but that in itself is the basis of a storyline.
Right. And they have the video footage to be able to help tell that story, to do the backstory
exactly.
on it.
Yeah. Exactly. Like, who else would have known all that stuff about Sting and would have been able to manipulate it? Eddie Gilbert, who is a guy who did magic tricks. Eddie Gilbert was a huge Jerry Lawler fan and threw fireballs.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Eddie Gilbert is the only person that it could have. Now, was right. Would it have drawn? Probably not. But you have a chance to actually tell a story about the term jilted lover comes to mind, but he's not really lover. It's like, it's a jilted mentor, right?
Yeah.
Cause you see this, you hear this story a lot where you mentor somebody along, is like, you see something in them and then they get really good and they wind up surpassing you. And the Eddie Gilbert character could have easily have been like miffed because this guy that he took a shot on, that he saw the potential in before anybody else, brought this guy, mentored him along. And then he goes off and becomes the world champion. What happens to Eddie Gilbert? Right? It'd been very, very easy. And this is what's great, is you could use the Scorpion to launch that story. And then it could have become something completely different. And I think that's the biggest missed opportunity, the Black Scorpion, is it became all about the Scorpion. It became all about the mask and the magic and all that stuff. When what it should have been is it should have been a launching point to something else. Because that storyline could have, because again, it's always when the champion, when the overcoming babyface, when the guy who has to climb up the mountain reaches there, what else is there? There has to be another mountain for him to climb.
Mm-hmm.
And they never gave Sting that mountain. Like, again, the Scorpion's supposed to be it, but it's nothing. And it's not meant to be anything. Like, all he says, I made it up and didn't have any ideas for it, really, which is a lie, because you're clearly telling a story. Like, you have ideas, but you don't have an end point. So that's a problem when writing, especially writing wrestling or booking wrestling. You have to have an end point planned. And that end point should have been the next big thing. And that's where it should have gotten really personal. Because you could have done a really cool storyline where Eddie Gilbert, who knows everything about Sting, is now trying to break him.
Well,
And
it could have been perfect. And the thing about Eddie Gilbert is he could promo his ass off. He could have been able to tell that story on the microphone. He would have carried Sting on the microphone. He would have definitely gotten a ton of heat because he was a very good heel. Mm-hmm. If you take a look at some of that old Memphis stuff that he did, he was awesome.
He was excellent. Eddie Gilbert was absolutely excellent. He admired Jerry Lawler, right? He was a student of the game, and he got pro wrestling. The problem with Eddie Gilbert is that, one, he had his issues, which, again, it was early 90s. Yeah. A lot of guys had the same issues, but he wanted to be a booker, right? Mm-hmm. And in WCW, he was never going to get that spot because him and Flair didn't like each other, right? And him, and he wasn't an Ole guy, so Ole was never going to give him that shot. So, I mean, he would really need to have had someone believe in him and to like really, hey, we're going to go all in with this. But the problem is like they didn't have that plan. They didn't have an out, really. They just figured they would do it and then they would go somewhere else with it. And what it really does is it really derails Sting. It really hurts the first year of Sting's reign as a champion. And like, again, I think a lot of that is like, oh, Sting couldn't draw, is based on this. because like there's nothing for him to draw with. Like, what is tangible about this Black Scorpion? Why are we supposed to be interested? And again, this went on for 4 months.
Yeah, it was bad TV for 4 months.
Yeah.
And that was the problem with it. You know, honestly, they should have never done this Black Scorpion. I think everybody can agree with that. They should have immediately did the Luger heel turn and then went straight to the building towards Luger and Sting, right? And doing that, because at the time, you know, they were that next generation. Like, Flair was kind of the previous generation. They were ready for the fail. Well, most people were not ready for to let go of Flair.
No, but nobody's ready. Look, that's the problem. Yeah. It's but not
you
until...
can still do a Flair, or you can still do a Sting and Luger feud while Flair has some other stuff to do off the side.
Well, that's the problem too, is like remember that when Luger does get his title, right? Bash 91, it's Luger and Wyndham in this quickly thrown together cage match. They don't even have the belt in that pay-per-view.
Yeah.
They didn't even have the belt. They had the old floor, I think it was the Florida title with a plate over it. So they're trying to cover up, like, this is our world title. Like, it's like, and the fans are just chanting, "We want Flair" the whole time. Like, you talk about a bunch of fans shitting out a hole. And by the way, the pay-per-view was god awful, atrocious,
awful. Yeah,
awful. It has the most boring chain match in the history. Like, Punk and MJF like to brag about the greatest dog collar match or something like that. The worst chain match is Sting and Nikita Koloff. It's bloodless and boring, and it should have been good, and it was terrible, just terrible. So, like, yeah. So they do this Luger heel turn, right, at Bash 91, and they start building the Sting Luger feud. Well, Luger freaking quits.
Yeah, he becomes
2 months into his reign. Well, yeah, and then he's like, yeah, I'm out. And then like they finally do the match at Super Brawl, and Luger's enormous, juiced out of his gourd at that point, and then he's gone. So you never like, you got the match, but you couldn't, because Luger had already had his contract dates. He never showed up. He wasn't on TV for like 2 months leading into this. So you never really had that true Sting Luger thing. That's why Sting's feuding with the Dangerous Alliance, because they couldn't get Luger on the show. Like, it's the ineptitude of WCW is just, and it's my favorite company ever. Like, that's just the worst part. It's like, I look back on WCW with like all these fond memories, and I'm like, look how awful this was. Like, constantly.
Yeah. The funny thing about Luger is he very publicly burned WCW to go to WWF. Mm-hmm. And then he, 3 years later, very publicly burns WWF to go right back to WCW.
With
he
a pay
burned
cut.
Them both. Yeah, with a pay
it's
cut.
A massive pay cut.
Yeah, he burned them both, which I find hilarious. It's kind of like that one thing, you know, the thing that they say is like, hey, don't ever get with a guy or a girl like that cheated, or don't ever get this cheating on their husband, because they're gonna do it to you, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Don't ever think that you're like, I think I forgot the cliche goes, but if you're with a girl who's cheating on her husband, there's a good chance she's gonna cheat. Yeah, we both butchered that whole thing, but that's basically what Lex Luger was, right? Yeah. And you know what's funny? When Luger comes back to WCW in '95, like, the first 3 years of that return are really good from him.
Oh, awesome. Yeah,
like, it's the work of his career.
97, Luger, tremendous.
Mm-hmm. Tremendous babyface. Late 95, Luger as a heel. Like, when him and Sting, I don't know if anybody's ever seen this, because late 90, like, people don't talk about the early Nitros. They talk about the NWO Nitros. But those, like, the best story of those early Nitros is the Sting-Luger tag team, where Sting is a babyface and Luger's a piece of shit heel. And everybody's like, Sting, why are you with this guy? And it's like, he's my best friend. He's like, yeah, he's a piece of shit, but he's my piece of shit. So, and it's like in there with Jimmy Hart, and it's just like Luger will be, yeah, babyface. And Sting will turn around and Luger, like, fake smacking a kid in the crowd or something like that. It's so great. Like, yeah, those two, like, oh, it's so good. Like, those two had such unbelievable chemistry together. Like, which is, again, what makes the Sting Crow stuff work. Because Luger turned his back on him, and Sting's like, I had your fucking back for a year, and some dork dresses like me, and you buy it? Fuck this place, you know? There's no more understandable character than 1996 Sting that has just absolutely had it with this environment and this bullshit that he's put up with for 6 years. And he's like, you people, I'm out. I hate all you people. I'm going to go sit in the rafters for a year.
And still get paid. I love
it. Got paid well. Didn't have a tan, though, so that hurt him.
I love it, man. Well, this was a lot of fun going down memory lane, talking some Black Scorpion, one of the worst angles in WCW history. I think we could do a lot of podcasts just based off of bad WCW angles, honestly.
I agree 100%. They're more fun to talk about than W, because when WWE does bad stuff, it just kind of fizzles out. When WCW did bad stuff, it was like spectacularly bad.
Yeah.
And there's like potential.
They committed,
but there's like, I still maintain they could have done something with the Scorpion. Like the two Undertaker thing was just terrible from the jump, and it never, I mean, like, I'll maintain the double Undertakers is worse than Black Scorpion.
Ooh, that's a hot take.
I don't
disagree with you, but the dual Undertaker did sell out the United Center.
I was one of those.
So I was couldn't there. Hated it that much.
Oh no, I did. I was 14 and jaded. Like I'm like, yeah. This is stupid. I was there for Bret and Owen in the cage. I was that I was a smark even back then. Like, yeah.
That's funny.
Oh, it's terrible, man. Look, like I know that was the main event, but I will argue that it was Bret and Owen. That did it, because like nobody bought that. That Undertaker thing was just, it was awful. Absolutely awful. They had Leslie Nielsen, excuse me.
Yeah.
If they had Liam Neeson, that would have been fucking awesome. No, they had Leslie Nielsen from the Naked Gun, like doing a search for Undertaker in the arena. God, that was Jesus. Yeah, no, I'm going to say that. The two Undertakers was worse than the Black Scorpion.
And that, but they also had Chuck Norris come out and do a spin kick on Jeff Jarrett. Wasn't that the same one?
No, that was when that was Undertaker Yokozuna. That was like the next
Survivor Series. That was Survivor Series 94.
Survivor Series. Yeah, that's where the Undertaker died. That was before. Okay, no, that was before. That was a year before. That's when Undertaker died. Remember?
And then the lasers got resurrected through the coffin up to the heavens. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're talking about pro wrestling, folks.
This is
in the hobby. It's not easy being a fan of ripping packs or repacks. We hype ourselves up thinking, maybe I can pull a Ken Griffey Jr. rookie card, but with zero transparency on available cards and hit rates, it's all just a shot in the dark. Until now. Introducing Slab Packs from ArenaClub.com, the only repack that provides real value, a complete view of all possible cards, and clear hit rates for each one. Now, when I buy Slab Packs at Arena Club, it finally feels like I know what I'm getting. I was able to open an Arena Club slab pack, and I'll be honest, it was a lot better than what you normally do. Say you go to a card show and there's a random innocuous brown bag of cards, and yeah, you can open it and look, it's going to be junk. You know what I mean? Like, you know what you're probably going to get in those. Maybe you find that fun, and sometimes I do. Sometimes I like just opening up cards and saying, hey, look at some random cards or whatever. But if you're really in this game to find value and find particular cards, it sucks to have to buy these mystery packs, and it ends up being, you know, almost nothing, you know, nothing of value. Not with Arena Club. You get a display, again, of all available cards, hit rates, grading, so you know that when you're opening up the slab pack, you are going to get something valuable. You are getting something good. And Arena Club, in addition to having those great slab packs we just talked about, is also a marketplace for card collecting, buying, trading, selling, displaying, all that sort of stuff. But those Arena Club slab packs, man, they are revolutionizing the repack game with transparency. After your pulls are revealed, they'll immediately be placed in your vault for safekeeping or trading and selling, and you can have them officially graded by Arena Club as well. So again, sending these things off, it's going to be officially graded by Arena Club. And the Arena Club grading process is accurate, fast, and transparent, with full grade rationale provided and explanation of how your card was scored. So whether you're buying, selling, trading, or displaying, Arena Club is the card collecting platform that you have to check out. So right now, I've got a special offer here for Voices of Wrestling Network listeners. You can get 10% off of your first purchase by going to arenaclub.com/VOWnet. Again, that's arenaclub.com/VOWnet. Now, that's a crazy offer. That's 10% off a $400 slab pack. $40 off right there. 10% off your first purchase. No matter what that purchase is, 10% off. Off. Again, that's arenaclub.com/VOWnet, arenaclub.com/VOWnet for 10% off your first purchase on Arena Club. And we thank them for sponsoring the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. What's going on, guys? This is Rich from the Flagship Podcast here on the Voice of Wrestling Podcast Network. If I could have a moment of your time, I'd like to tell you about one of our sponsors, Eufy Video Lock. Eufy Video Lock is a smart lock, a 2K camera, and a doorbell, all 3-in-1, offering you triple security. So you can have everything in one device rather than installing many pieces on your front door. But it's not just for security. The Eufy Video Lock is also for convenience. No more concerns about losing keys, and you can assign passwords to your family members and see them coming back home via the integrated cameras. Some other great features we love about the Eufy Video Lock is it is easy to install and set up with just a Phillips screwdriver, no drilling required. Keyless entry, no more fumbling for keys when your hands are full. You never have to worry about kids losing keys or passing among renters. You also have 0.3 second fingerprint recognition and 1 second unlocking. Again, 0.3 seconds, it's going to recognize your fingerprints, and in 1 second, it's going to unlock. And with the AI self-learning chip embedded, the more you use it, the more accurate it will be. Also, no battery anxiety. You have a rechargeable battery in there that could last around 4 months, and you will get a low battery notification before it runs out. Passcode unlocking, a remote control with a 2K clear sight, see who's at your door, and control from anywhere through the Eufy app. With enhanced night vision, you can have optimized view even in the evening. You can also secure your package delivery by view and two-way audio. And then best of all, no monthly fee. A bunch of other brands out there are going to charge you a monthly fee. You have your recordings locally and you never have to pay for storage. Customer service, Eufy's got you handled as well. They are on standby for you 24/7, so you can enjoy a worry-free experience with an 18-month warranty, all backed by their professional customer service team. Contact them anytime by telephone, email, or live chat. Personally, as a homeowner, I love my Eufy Video Lock. I have the ability to see what's going on when I'm not home, when packages has arrived. And really the thing I love the most about it, the ease of being able to lock and unlock my doors without having to fumble with my keys, reach in my pocket, or wait, no, crap, they're in my backpack, all that sort of stuff. All this is happening while my dogs are barking at me. You know what? Not anymore with the Eufy Video Lock. I touch it. 0.3 second fingerprint recognition, 1 second. Door is unlocked. Much, much easier. So if you want to jump on board with Eufy Video Lock, search Eufy Video Lock. That is E-U-F-Y Video Lock. Again, that's Eufy Video Lock, E-U-F-Y Video Lock, or visit eufyofficial.com/videolock to see how you can gain complete control of your door.
At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
You guys are so spoiled today that like the pro wrestling you get, you know, and like I hear people talk about dumb pro wrestling stuff. You don't even like, this is worse than the peak of the Fiend. This shit was way worse than that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really, really bad, but I love to talk about it. JD, this is a lot of We got a really cool thing to talk about this week. You wrote an article earlier this week for the Patreon. It ended up going to a Voices of Wrestling too, so it got spread out wide. But you did release it on Patreon first. So yeah, and the title of the article was "Greener Grass: Why Bookers from the Past Aren't Always the Best Solution," and it was shit in reference title. I like it.
I thought it was like super genius at the time, and then I saw when Rich put the version for the Voices out, I was like, my title fucking blows, man. I was really disappointed in that.
but it was in reference to, so this dipshit from a NoDQ.com. NoDQ is kind of an aggregate site, but they kind of let anybody write opinion pieces for their site. They have a huge following too, by the way, like on Twitter, but they buy their followers.
Yeah. Man. It's not real.
They have followed me about 12 times in hopes that I would follow them back. And I just never do.
I blocked them because I got tired of them asking, like doing the same gag. And I, you know, I don't, I got no time for that shit. Kablock. Yeah.
So, they had this, this article, and why don't you go ahead and tell us what the article was about?
So the article is basically about how AEW is a gigantic failure. And you read these things all the time from people, and I'm going in there and it's like, oh, everything is bad. The show is bad. Tony can't control his locker room. And it's like, you know, there's kernels of truth, but then he was like, he needs to hire people who know what they're doing. He is inexperienced. He needs to hire people who knows what he's doing. And he referenced Dutch Mantel, Vince Russo, Eric Bischoff. Who else was in there? Who's who of failures.
Yeah.
And like, I read this and I'm like, so AEW's been on for 4 years at this point. They just sold. They didn't sell at Wembley. They had a good number, debatable, at Wembley Stadium. They're about to get a $1 billion TV deal. Tony Khan is more successful than any of these guys.
Yeah,
Tony Khan is the second most successful booker of the modern era at this point, right?
I'm sure there's some folks that can argue about the, you know, Japanese bookers and things like that, but as far as our country,
Americans, yeah.
Domestically, it would be him. Of the last 30 years, it's him and Vince, right?
Yeah, it's him and Vince. Like, excuse me. Like, you could say Kevin Sullivan, because Eric didn't book anything. Eric wasn't a booker. And like, when all these guys have had second cracks, it's all failed. Like, AEW has outlasted Smoky Mountain, right? And when people look back on Smoky Mountain fondly, you're talking about 92, 93. By 94, they're bringing in WWF guys and Cornette's tanked the company, right?
Yeah.
And then Cornette got his second chance booking Ring of Honor and managed to do worse than the guy that came before him, who was Adam Pearce, actually. Like, he managed to not do as well. So it's like all these, and Dutch Mantel, like, you can't tell me you were watching his stuff in Puerto Rico, and I can tell you when he was running TNA, it wasn't as good.
Yeah, right? Well, he was basically Jeff Jarrett's secondhand. So he was part of creative, but Jeff Jarrett was booking the company. Dutch was just a guy giving ideas. Vince Russo and Jarrett was in charge. Vince and Dutch worked for Jarrett. There were times where Dixie made Vince outrank Jarrett, but for the most part, it was Jarrett, Dutch, and Vince.
Yeah, pretty much. And it got me thinking about how when I wrote a piece for who the hell did I used to work for?
Fansided.
Fansided. And it was the same time, similar. That was when Vince hired Eric Bischoff and Paul Heyman to run Raw and SmackDown. And I said, it's not going to work. And I wrote a big thing about how Eric coming into TNA. Now that didn't work. And that experiment lasted like 4 months. And then Vince was like, no, they're gone. You know? And then this one, it got me thinking about this guy. Because again, it was a terribly written, terribly researched article. Like, the guy was calling for, he was calling for Action Bronson to get fired. That is not a person.
and if he's talking about Action Bronson doesn't work there. So that'd be
Action
easy to
Bronson
fire a guy.
Doesn't work there. Action Andretti does work there. Somehow he conflated the two and demanded that person be fired. It was just like, this is the most poorly researched article and written article that I've ever read. But it inspired me to talk about, because he's not alone. This isn't like the first time someone has said this. Like, every time something happens, they want, Freddie Prinze. He wanted Freddie Prinze should book the promotion.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I got to thinking about, like, people want the voices from when they think wrestling was good to still be involved. And it made me think that back in the early 90s, when WCW became a thing, the constant call from there was two people the news writers were demanding should book WCW. One was Hot Stuff Eddie Gilbert, who shot himself in the foot everywhere he went, but he had the newsletter writers in his pocket so he could get them to sing his praises whenever he want. And he wasn't that great of a booker, I'll tell you. I mean, he was all right, but I mean, like, go back and watch some of those, what was the name of that promotion he booked? Continental, those CWF shows. Ain't good. I'll tell you that for a fact. And that was going to be like his thing. So the other one was Bill Watts. And for years, because in 1984, when Bill Watts got his big shot, when he was put on TBS TV, because Ted Turner was mad at Vince for not doing an Atlanta show. So he gave a crack to Ole Anderson's new Georgia promotion, and he also put Mid-South on. And when the WWF was getting hot in 85, the number one show on television, cable TV, was Mid-South Wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
And because we talked about it last year, we both did like a rewatch of 84 Mid-South. The show yeah. was great. Like it was fantastic. Absolutely great. Watts wasn't booking though at that.
No,
that was Bill Lundy that was booking.
Yeah,
that
from
show.
Memphis. So, mm-hmm. and if you like the early days of AEW, it was very heavily influenced by 1984 Mid-South. Like tons of like run-ins, hot finishes, things like that. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, beatdowns before the bell. You know what I mean? Like AEW, Tony Khan, he's inspired. He's got a lot of inspirations when it comes to his booking. Obviously very inspired by Bill Watts' Mid-South. There's some TNA influence there. Mm-hmm. There's some ECW influence. And of course, he's probably a little bit influenced by Vince. He tries to take the good that they all do. Yeah, he tries to take the good that they all do and incorporate it into his company, which I think is smart. But I think the overall tone had a lot of 1984 Mid-South and like 1996, 1997 WCW Nitro with mm-hmm. the party-like atmosphere that they had in the early days of AEW Dynamite. The influencers are there. The influences are there. So I would strongly recommend people go out of the way to go watch that. It's on YouTube. There's a playlist out there. So.
There's a playlist out there. The network, the Peacock, has all those shows, but it's not the same because you don't get the unlicensed music. And
yeah.
part of the fun of Mid-South is the unlicensed music. It's watching Junkyard Dog come out to Another One Bites the Dust. It's like it's listening to the Rock and Roll Express come out to ELO. Like there's the music is a big part of it. So you lose a big something when you don't watch the pirated shows. Yeah. But anyways, Watts was a smart man in that he always like when his territory first got hot in the early 80s. When Junkyard Dog, he had Ernie Ladd booking the show. So that was good. And then he did his deal with Memphis, right? That they traded. I believe it was they traded Rick Rude, and maybe King Kong Bundy. Yeah, King Kong Bundy to Memphis for the Rock and Roll Express and the Midnight Express and Jim Cornette. So they had this legit trade. And then with them, Bill Dundee came in, right? So Bill Dundee took all his Memphis influence and mixed it with Bill Watts's, you know, legitimate tough guy stuff. And it made for just great TV, mm-hmm. right? So they're hot on TBS in the 80s. Big, big event. And if you go back and, like I said, you go back and watch. You watch an episode of 1984 Mid-South from the same week. Pick an episode of Championship Wrestling, WWF. Even pick an episode of Crockett. There's not even a comparison. Mid-South is far and away the better show. Far and away. So Watts, so when shit went south with, was going south with Vince and Ted Turner, Watts thought he was going to get the spot. He thought he was going to get that World Championship Wrestling. When I say World Championship Wrestling, I'm not talking about WCW. I'm talking about the show, the 605 time slot. That was the TV show was called World Championship Wrestling. It was called World Championship Wrestling when Georgia had it. It was called World Championship Wrestling when Vince had it. And it was called World Championship Wrestling when the guy that swept in from underneath Watts's nose and bought the spot from Vince, and that was Jim Crockett. Jim Crockett bought it, and that's why the company was called WCW, because the name of the show that had been on since the late 70s was called World Championship Wrestling. They even had the same intro for all three promotions. That
it was kind of like Wide World of Sports or something.
Yeah,
like that,
very
they,
much.
It was like the same, and then they would just kick it to the current wrestling promotion that had the time slot, mm-hmm. right? So they kept all of the other stuff the same. Just the promoter and the wrestlers would change over time because different people would get in on the time slot.
Right. So when Crockett makes his deal to come on to TBS, he buys the spot from Vince, very famous $1 million. Hope you'll choke on that million. He kind of did. And they thought that Watts was pissed because Watts like, I'm the guy who brought the ratings. Crockett is just coming out of nowhere. Fortunately, Crockett gets super hot in 85. Like everything clicks when Crockett goes to TBS. Like it's crazy. Watts still had his syndication network. Like Watts had syndicators. Like he followed the WWF model and he had syndicators across the country. And he's like, we're going national. So he was doing his own thing. Eventually in 86, he rebrands to the UWF. So I don't think it was a good move. It was kind of the beginning of the end.
But I can see why he did that though, sure. Because like they wanted it to seem
bigger.
Like they didn't want to be like a regional promotion because it would be like World Championship Wrestling, and then they were called Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling or Mid-Atlantic Wrestling. So no, you don't want that because this is going out all over the country. So you want that bigger vibe and the bigger feel. So I get why he did that.
The problem was calling it UWF. Which sounds exactly like WWF, but the universe is bigger than the world. Yeah. Same rationale Vince uses on his belts currently. So I get why he did it. He should have picked a different title. Anyways, by early 86, the Oklahoma oil economy completely collapses and they just aren't selling tickets to the shows in the home markets. And that's the lifeblood of the company.
Well, and they lost JYD.
That happened way earlier. That happens in 84. Like they're hot. Like when they're the number one show on TV, JYD is gone. Like this is what Watts did well is he booked, like they left JYD, but they're still selling. They do great business after JYD leaves because they have the Rock and Roll Express. And then when the Rock and Roll Express leaves, they have Hacksaw Jim Duggan. The problem is he couldn't let go of JYD. So he had he kept trying to make the next black baby face and it never works. Right. But at the same time, they had guys who were drawing, like the Rock and Roll Express in particular, were huge main event draws for that company, right? They had Hacksaw Jim Duggan, huge main event draw. The problem is when Duggan leaves, they try to make Dr. Death the next guy, and it doesn't quite work, right?
So by Dr. Death just wasn't ready for the spot yet.
No, he wasn't there. He wasn't
ready. And they still had DiBiase pretty much till the end.
Top heel. He was the top heel.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's good. It's still a good show, but by the end, like they have Michael Hayes books and Eddie Gilbert books at the very end, and eventually, Jim Ross negotiates a deal where they sell the UWF to Crockett. Crockett buys it and takes the network, and then so Watts, the idea that not even Watts, but Jim Ross pitches Jim Crockett was we could have the Super Bowl wrestling. UWF has its show. WCW or Jim Crockett as it shows once a year we come together big event, and Dusty didn't let it happen. What they did was they took Watts's offices in Dallas and moved the company to Dallas and spent way more money than they had to, and then they were broke 6 months later and had to sell to Turner. So not quite like the Ring of Honor situation with Tony Khan, more like Vince. It's closer to Vince buying WCW that we talked about last time. Anyway, Watts sells, and then he is gone from pro wrestling for 5 years. And in that time, all these newsletter readers who have fond memories of Mid-South Championship or Mid-South Wrestling are saying, you know who WCW should bring to run WCW? You know who should bring to run WCW? Bill Watts. Bill Watts would do a great job here. And Dave was chief among them, quite frankly, at that time. Mm-hmm. And then it happened. WCW hired Bill Watts to run the promotion. At a time that they were starting to get more popular, because Herd leaves in the summer of 91 after the Flair debacle, the company is at its absolute lowest. And by mid 92, they're starting to turn things around. They're starting to do better. And Bill Watts comes in, and Dave put it the best. Dave said, at that point, I realized Bill Watts had not watched wrestling in 5 years. And if you watch pro wrestling from 1987 and compare it to pro wrestling from 1992, it's a different world.
Completely different world. And he's not booking just one TV show. WCW had several TV shows all over TBS at the time. They weren't on TNT yet, but they had the Saturday Night Show. They had WC Worldwide, WCW Pro, Main Event too. Was Main Event still around? So they had four shows plus Clash of the Champions and their pay-per-views. So they had a lot.
Well, Worldwide was on syndication. Right. So Worldwide was on syndicated markets across the country. Main Event had its own show in Chicago on top of the TBS one. Like we had a special version of Main Event here. That was Chicago centric. Yeah. Jack Brickhouse and Tony Schiavone would do the wraparounds, and it was a different show. It was meant for here. It's kind of cool. It didn't really work. But they're like four or five shows that Watts setting. Now Dusty Rhodes is the booker, and right away, Watts comes in and he makes all these ridiculous changes both on camera and off.
Yeah. My favorite one. You didn't want guys jumping off the top rope.
Yep.
that was like the kicker. I was like, why like, of all the rules to make, why that rule?
Because that was the rule in Mid-South. They had these big dudes who, like, you jump off the top, you could kill somebody. 3 months earlier, Brian Pillman and Jushin Thunder Liger have the best North American match in a decade.
Super and those Brawl two 1992.
Are yeah. Brawl 92, and those fuckers are jumping all over the place. Yeah. You know, it was always you can't throw a guy over the top rope. But then Watts decides that having the mats circling the ring makes the guys look soft. So he takes those away and he changes the work style. And then, so he changes the work style. He puts all these rules in. You have to show up when the show starts. You can't leave till the show ends, regardless of where you are on the card. Like, he puts all these ridiculous rules into place. So the guys immediately hate right away. But the interesting was he was going to get the story. It's never been official, but speculated that Bill Watts was brought in to get the spending under control. And he would get a bonus based on how much money he could cut from the budget. So the first person he goes after is Brian Pillman, who signed this big deal. He was going to be the star of the junior heavyweight division. And he said, "We'll keep your push going if you take a pay cut." And Brian Pillman said, "Fuck you. I will be the highest paid. I will be the highest paid jobber in history." And he was for like 3 or 4 months. He lost everything. And that fucker did not care, like, because he was getting paid. And it was pretty bad. Eventually they turned Pillman heel and the rest is history. But I mean, and about a month into the Watts tenure, everybody figured out that, oh my God, he's out of touch.
Yeah. You can't not watch wrestling for 5 years and then try to bring in ideas from 5 years ago as if they're still current and relevant. You can bring in like templates and things like that, like but you have to modernize those things. You have to update those things. It's true in any type of business. Sometimes you got to take a couple steps back so you can go forward. You don't want to take 5 years worth of steps back. You know what I mean? It would be like, you know, the New York Jets ran the shotgun offense in the 70s. It'd be like, you know, Vince Lombardi coming in there and say, "Oh no, we're only doing running plays and you're only going to throw it, you know, 10 times a game." And then trying to win a Super Bowl. It wouldn't actually work. He took his ideology over to, I think, the Redskins, and he didn't do so well over there because he was a little bit out of touch. He'd been, his ideas were from the 60s, but he's got to coach for the 70s. You got to update your style, right? You got to continue moving forward and continue thinking forward. And you got to make sure that you don't have to watch everything, but your scouting department is watching all these other different areas and finding out what the new cool hip things are. Something that he was doing in 1984. He was one of the guys, early adopters of bringing in like rock and roll music and, you know, bringing in the girls at Rock and Roll Express. You know, who else did pretty well in Mid-South was the Fantastics and things like that. But those guys, the way they looked in 1992, like that style didn't really work anymore. They're like the little teeny bopper tag teams. They didn't really, you know, work anymore in 1992. So you have to update those things. And not only was it his idea of what wrestling should be, it was the way he treated people was obviously way behind the times, because now he's going from this little regional territory where he is the end-all be-all, but now he's going into Turner and he's got a ton of bosses. And, oh, it turns out that this redneck from the South said some pretty racist shit. They found out about it. I think Wade Keller did an interview with him and he said some pretty horrendous stuff.
It was Mark Madden, but it was a torch talk with Mark Madden.
Yeah.
And Madden gets him to, because Bill Watts is this. Bill Watts was like a libertarian before libertarianism was like, you know, I don't want to say cool because I don't think it's ever been cool. But I mean, like, there was a time about 10, 15 years ago where, you know, people who were libertarian were like the edgy people. I'm a libertarian. I have like a social conscience, but I believe in like cutting and like you not paying fiscal taxes conservative and shit like that.
And I just want to own my guns and smoke my weed and hang out with my gay friends. Like, that was like a big thing with libertarians.
That was what they were like in the late 2000s. But anyways, so Watts, similarly, like Watts, the guy who was known as the first dude to push black men to the top of his promotion. He did it with Ray Candy in the late 70s. He did it with Junkyard Dog. He did it with Hacksaw Butch Reed. He comes to WCW, and out of nowhere, Ron Simmons, who's a mid-card guy, beats Vader for the world title. Mm-hmm. Like Vader had beaten Sting a month earlier, and then on a like it was great. They're gonna have the rematch. It's a great angle, actually. Sting gets hurt, and they basically have to do like a lottery. They pick a dude from backstage, and it's Ron Simmons. And Ron Simmons comes out and beats Vader at center stage. And because there's a lot of black kids that would go watch the matches at center stage, right? So yeah. Ron Simmons wins, and these kids flood the ring. Awesome. It's the highlight. It's the highlight of Watts' tenure at WCW. They never really follow up on it. But in that one moment, that Ron Simmons winning the title is just awesome. It's an awesome scene. This is the same guy that gives an interview to Mark Madden and says stuff like, why should a black guy have any kind of special advantages over a white guy? Why should I have to hire black people? Why should I like these? I'm paraphrasing. He says some ridiculously abhorrent shit. And it's funny because at Starrcade 92, he's standing in the center of the ring with another Ted Turner employee who was the Goodwill ambassador for the Atlanta Braves. Do you know who that was, Mike?
The greatest baseball player that ever fucking lived in Hank Aaron.
That'd be correct, Hank Aaron. Yeah. And then Mark Madden, the eternal shit stirrer that he is, sends Hank Aaron his article. So Hank Aaron gets a copy of it, reads it, and is like, this guy works for us?
Yeah.
Very shortly, Watts did not work for Ted Turner. It's
crazy because he said all those things, but his actions were different because, he always pushed black stars because he knew they could draw money. Yep. And Ernie Ladd was like his booker for a little while. Like Ernie Ladd was always treated with reverence. But the shit that he said was completely awful. He was just so out of touch. Didn't quite understand where the country was. He was saying shit that would probably fly in the 60s. 1992, it's a different world, you know what I mean? And he just hadn't updated his ideology, and so, and it was just awful.
Like what happened in the spring of 92, do you recall?
That would be the Rodney King incident, right?
That would be the riots,
LA riots.
The Rodney King thing happened in 90. The trial spread out.
Yes.
And like, so for guys that might be younger, Rodney King was this, we see it too often now, but at the time he was a black motorist that was high and he was pulled out of his vehicle. And these, I think it was six LA cops,
six LA cops on camera beat the shit out of this guy. Just like, it was like a gang style jumping. It was bad.
It wasn't just fists. I mean, they're using their nightsticks. They are beating the shit out of this guy. It's unbelievable. And actually, if you pay attention, it's perfectly believable.
Yeah.
But like,
yeah,
this was in 1990. This was unbelievably shocking news because in the late 80s and early 90s, people started having access to portable video equipment. Right. So this dude saw this happening and grabbed his over the shoulder video camera and recorded the whole thing. It's like 10 minutes long. So these guys go to trial. And I believe they were found not guilty. I don't even think they were acquitted. I believe they were found not guilty. And LA burns. Like there were riots in the streets. Like it was, I remember being a little kid. I was like 12 when this happened. And this was major, major news. And this is right around the time that Bill Watts gave that interview to the Torch. Might have been kind of what was on his mind when he was thinking about this stuff, actually.
Yeah. So he was just this, at this point, he was not only out of touch with wrestling, he was out of touch completely with society. And you want to know who, after he got fired in 1993, who ended up hiring him to come work for him?
That'd be Vince McMahon.
Vince McMahon. So even after all the shit that he said, he ended up going into the Hall of Fame later, I guess, because they feel like because he's Bill Watts and like his booking style was the antithesis of what he said in that interview, which is why there's such a dichotomy with this guy. He's so hard to figure out. Like
people
where does
are complicated.
He really stand? Yeah, he's super complicated. Yeah, he's a super complicated guy.
Hilarious because Bill Watts actually ran when WWF was drawing shit in 95. 95 is the worst year of WWF wrestling ever, up there with 2019. Like it was awful. And the company is not drawing, and they bring it. So Vince is like, okay, Watts is going to run the company now, right? And Watts's idea was to build a black baby face. Do you know who Watts's guy that they were going to build the WWF around was?
It'd be Ahmed Johnson.
It would be no. That would be Mo Adib from the Global Wrestling Federation. One Tony Norris, Bill yeah. Watts named him Buck Johnson, like young strapping bucks, which was a derogatory term for black men.
And I did not know that.
Yes, he was going to be Buck Johnson, and Vince overruled and said, "No, we'll call him Ahmed." I don't know where they got that one, probably from Ahmad Rashad or something like that, because Vince likes to do that with names.
Right.
So then it was Ahmed Johnson, and then they had another argument, and Bill Watts quit. There can only the famous quote, famous quote: "There can only be one Titan in Titan Sports."
Yeah, yeah, and he actually was. Guess who worked with the audience? I'm JD knows, but so just the audience, just a fun trivia fact: the guy that was working with him in creative at the time was kind of like his understudy was Vince Russo, of all people.
That's true. Yeah, that's a hard in a roundabout. Dude, Vince Russo has, say what you want about the guy, he's got a fascinating story about how he got into this company. Vince Russo got into this company because he owned a video store that was sponsoring John Arezzi's radio show. And then Vince, because he was his money guy, got involved in like the production of the show. And then they were going, because Arezzi goes hard against the steroid stuff and the child rape stuff, and then
explain who John Arezzi is real quick. Arezzi had a radio show in the New York, New Jersey, like the tri-state area, called Pro Wrestling Spotlight, and it was actually on FM radio there. And Vince Russo would buy advertising time on the Pro Wrestling Spotlight show for his video store. So that's how he came up. And so they eventually became partners. They eventually became partners. And I think that, they actually put together and sold and got in business with one James E. Cornette on a Midnight Express, like highlight video that they had kind of put together and got in. So they were actually like in a roundabout way, Jim Cornette is partially responsible for the rise of Vince Russo, which
the president of the Jim Cornette fan club hooked up Arezzi and Vince Russo. True story.
Yeah. It played out on the Jim Cornette podcast. Yeah, so when he found that out. Yeah, it was great.
Jim Cornette goes, "It's my fault. All of him in this is my fault." It's like the best come to Jesus moment in podcast history. Like, you could hate Cornette, but that's just an epic, epic moment in podcasting. Anyway, so they're going hard against Titan for all this stuff, Titan Gate. And then Vince McMahon has a meeting with Vince Russo. Russo comes back and goes, "Hey, we're going about this all wrong. We need to be positive with WWF. They want to work with us." And Arezzi's like, "No, these people are fucking scumbags." So Russo kicks Arezzi off his own show.
Mm-hmm.
And that winds up Russo, the show eventually fails, and Russo gets a job at the magazine.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, Vince basically, Vince came in, talked to Vince Russo, got Arezzi kicked off the show, then became a WWE Spin Zone show, and then he ended up getting work on the magazine and then worked his way up to the company. Yeah. When he actually got fired from Vince Russo. Now, I know we're bouncing around, so we talked Bill Watts to death. There are some WCW 1992 under Bill Watts and 93 that I really liked, by the way. Mm-hmm. I actually did a WCW Saturday Night Rewatch of 92 and 93. And I loved it on a lot of that stuff. They brought in Terry Gordy and Dr. Death as from Japan, even though they were all Japan and they had a relationship with New Japan. That was bad. So, but there was a lot of good wrestling, I thought. And that was the rise of the Hollywood Blondes during that time too, right?
Oh yeah. Well, the tag division's awesome. The Steiners and Doc and Gordy is awesome. That rivalry is great. Both guys are out of the company. Everyone's out of the company 3 months later. But yeah, you get that's when I became a fan of WCW, was in the fall of 92. So like, that is like my prime era. And people are like, "Oh, it was so bad." But it's like, when you watch that stuff, it's as good as what WWF was doing at the time. Like, cause most of that product was shit too. But I mean, like, I like WCW 92, 93. I got a soft spot for it. So, and I agree. Some of the stuff that Watts did was all right. The Jake, like Kip Fry hired Jake Roberts. And they brought him in to be the lead heel of WCW. And it starts off pretty good. He has this great attack on Sting. It's not quite as good as the Savage stuff, but what is? That's career shit for both those two. But it's pretty good. And then it ends just bad. It's a great metaphor for kind of where the Watts tenure is. Like, there's so much hope going in. And by the end of it, it's just like, oh, you know?
Yeah. And shit. You know, another little trivia thing about Vince Russo. I don't know why I know so much about that idiot, but yeah.
Because you host an Impact podcast, my friend.
That is true. So when he got fired from Impact, and like he was brought in early, and then they were going to early in the NWA TNA days. So he was brought in early, and they were working on trying to get Hulk Hogan there in the early days. And so to prove that they would do business with Hulk, they let go of Vince Russo. Then Vince, I think this was on his first excursion. He was fired there a few times.
Couple.
Then Vince takes some time off. He takes some time away from wrestling. He has not watched WWF and forever WWE, but Vince McMahon brought him in to be on the creative team. And he came in, and he had been separated from the WWE since 1999 at that point. So we're talking like 3 or 4 years. He didn't know shit about anybody on that television show. They brought him into one creative meeting to see what he still had. He had no juice left, and they went ahead and shit-canned him and told him
one day,
you never mind. Yeah, he lasted one day. And this idiot from the No DQ site, what should we name this guy or no? I mean, this is Patreon.
I don't even remember his name on the Patreon. I did not link the article on the Voices. Okay. Rich says we have to link the article. Do we gotta give this guy oxygen? And Rich's like, it's killing me to do this, but you referenced it. We have to. And I'm like, ah, you're right. I gotta do that. So yeah. I honestly forget the guy's name.
This is the Vince Russo that is still stuck into where he thinks a Braun Panties matches in 2023 would probably do a lot better on pro wrestling television than actual women's wrestling matches. Right?
Racist man himself won Vince Russo.
Yeah.
You don't believe me? Listen to this month's Between the Sheets Patreon show. My God, what a racist piece of shit that guy is.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a horrendous guy. Dutch Mantel, kind of doing a pro Trump thing, going after Dave all over Twitter. But you know what? If Dutch got hired on as creative, but to head creative, probably not. But you know, I don't know about Dutch. Yeah, he's super out of touch. The other name that kind of like threw out there was Al Snow. In what world? In what promotion is Al Snow ever booked that was successful?
He's booking OVW right now, sir.
Yeah, and it's one of the worst shows ever in the history of pro wrestling. It is bad. They got themselves on a Netflix, you know, as more of a documentary series. I have not watched it, but it's bad.
The whole show is about how they're about to go out of business every week.
Yeah.
Great booking.
Yeah. It's just, he bought that promotion from one, Danny Davis, not Dangerous Danny Davis, but, what was his Smoky Mountain name? Danny Davis.
Nightmare.
Danny Davis. Yeah. Davis, yeah. Yeah, so they bought it from him, took it over, and it has done jack shit. The only reason anybody ever knew about it is because it was the WWF Memphis was their first.
It was their first one that they kind of owned outright and built. They bought. Yeah. They didn't even own it. Actually, I take it back. They were just working with Danny. They just like, oh, Danny Davis is a really good trainer. What if we send all our guys to work with Danny Davis? And he was smart enough to have his school open at the same time. So he would get this mixture of guys. Like, there were a lot of people who got WWE contracts who started out in Danny Davis' school.
Yeah. Then, right. But so once WWE pulled out of there and stopped sending blue chip athletes over there, they didn't really produce anybody anymore. Not to say they're not good trainers, but they're like, can you name anybody from the last 10 years that's kind of come out of that school with, you know? I can't. Not to say that Rip Rogers can't train, right? I'm sure Allison knows how to wrestle. But Layla Gray.
Honest to God, the only person that's come out of there that people know is Layla Gray for being Jade's second in AEW.
Okay, I don't actually know who that is, but I'm sure
remember when Jade had her baddies? Not Red Velvet, not Kira Hogan, but
The other one. Okay, so one of the baddies. Yes. Okay.
That's it.
Okay.
That's all we got. Right.
All right. Yeah. So that was the other name. So look, you know, it is good sometimes to kind of go back to the past and bring in some of the ideas. Go ahead, JD.
Really quick. Do you know who the main player in OVW is right now?
It's Jesse Goddard's, isn't it?
Jesse Goddard's. You know Jesse Goddard, Mr. Spectacular. He probably follows everybody who listens to this show on Twitter.
He's followed me 17 times and I never follow back. Yeah.
I did follow him. That's how I know this. Do you know who he's currently working with?
Oh, it's EC3 because I saw the clip of Dixie Carter.
It's EC3 and EC3. Turns out, like, flirting with white nationalism was not good for EC3's narrative. He's back to being Ethan Carter III.
Yeah, and you know what? Good for Ethan Carter III, because I think he's looking at MJF doing his gimmick. That's the EC3 gimmick. He's doing it better than EC3 ever did it.
That's true.
But he stole the gimmick, right? And he just did it better than EC3 did. I think that that poor Ethan Carter, man, he left a lot of money on the table when he decided to go to the Control Your Narrative stuff. Now he's the NWA champion, but that can't really pay you too much.
That doesn't mean anything. I don't care where Tyrus is ranked in the PWI 500. Like, that doesn't... What a... Tetsuya Naito was not on the PWI 500. You're going to tell me that fucking Billy Starks is better or more valuable than Tetsuya Naito? Wait,
Billy Starks is on the PWI 500?
Yeah, Universal Intergender matches. You get to be on the PWI 500.
Okay, so the men that wrestled her, are they going to be on the women's list? Is that how it works?
I mean...
I mean, if we're equality, right?
I mean... I don't know, man. I don't know. Anthony Bowens isn't on the list either. He's a current champion in AEW, and he's actually a good worker.
Yeah,
Not on the PWI 500. Will Ospreay, not in the top 10.
And he's the best wrestler in the world.
In the world. You know,
I'm so glad that we didn't touch on that on the main show, because I probably would have got myself in trouble. Yeah.
I'm glad. Yeah. That's why I'm bringing it up now. Like, PWI is a kayfabe list. Love Warren Hayes. I love you. But, yeah.
Oh, does Warren Hayes do the PW? Is he like a voter?
He said, I like Warren. Warren's a good dude.
Yeah.
He said, I am not responsible for this, but I did help contribute to it. But I cannot speak for all of these, because I know Warren even's like, this is ridiculous, some of these things.
We should bring him on sometime and say, hey, Warren, did you at least think of Naito? Like, did he cross your mind?
Warren? Did you watch the G1 by chance?
Yeah, because he was. Did you watch the Forbidden Door? He was on that, yeah. And he was in a pretty big.
I can't blame Warren for this. I'm sure he's pulling the hair. I know he's a good dude. He knows wrestling. I'm sure he's pulling the hair out of his head looking at this list.
Yeah.
Because again, Masha Slamovich on the PWI 500, Tetsuya Naito off the PWI 500.
Yeah. And Masha's great, by the way, but I just think it's weird to have a women's list.
Not as good as Tetsuya Naito, man.
No, she's not. But I just think, am I the only one that thinks it's weird that to have like a women's list and then put women on the men's list, which I guess maybe it's just not a men's list. But if that's the case, then you should integrate all the women, right?
Let me tell you something. We have Illinois, in the state of Illinois, we have girls wrestling as an official sport now. It is an official IHSA sanctioned sport. Girls can still compete in the boys' division, if they want to.
Okay. I mean, I wrestled girls when I was in high school, some of them, but we didn't have a women's division. So
we have a women's division now, and we're trying to grow our women's division. I don't understand why.
I think it's awesome. Hey, I'm a girl dad. I think fucking girls, I coach
girls at Fargo. Like, I got no qualm with having girls wrestling. It's save amateur wrestling, quite frankly. Like, women's wrestling is the fastest growing sport in America. That is a fact. However, the fact that if they're good, they can go wrestle. They can opt out of the girls and wrestle in the boys makes me scratch my head. You know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't get it, but hey, whatever makes people happy, man. Like, I mean, in PWI, it's a kayfabe list. So and I saw how much that meant to Masha, and obviously I'm an Impact guy.
Oh,
so
happy for
it. I mean, that meant a lot to her. I just found it to be a little bit fun.
Billy Starks' dad was freaking out about it. It's awesome. Like, I'm really, it's cool. Cause for a lot of these people, it really helps make their career, like Jonathan Gresham. Well,
yeah. Yeah. Oh, was he on the list this year?
I'm sure he was, but that was like I don't know, but I hope it's not true. But that was the apocryphal story that was floating around last year when he was yelling at Tony Khan and was quoting his ranking in the stories he was quoting his ranking in PWI 500. I hope that's not true. I hope that's not true.
Yeah, I hope it's not true. But hey, guys, I think that's going to do it. Again, if you like Overdrive, JD and I kind of get a little weird on this show, but we are. Oh, yeah. Overtime. Sorry. JD and I like to get a little bit weird on this, but we've actually just been doing historical topics. So if you got a topic you want us to talk about, we're game.
Yeah.
Give us ideas. Tell us what to talk about. We'll do some research. JD kind of has a lot of this knowledge off the top of his head already, but we'll read into it. We'll look into it and then we'll talk about it, man. So give us some ideas. But hey,
We got no ideas what we're talking about next week. So, hey,
yeah,
you got
some Yeah. But hey, guys, that's going to do it for us on Overtime this week. And until next time, mahalo. Hey now, it's Mike Gilbert, host of the Mike and JD Show, right here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Join JD by God Oliva and myself every Thursday night live on the Voices of Wrestling YouTube channel at 11:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time as we stay up all night discussing all the hottest stories in professional wrestling. You can also check us out right here on the Voices of Wrestling podcasting feed, or you can subscribe to the Mike and JD Show feed. Now, enjoy the show.